Case is 98-1179, Courtney DuBois versus Akron Public Schools.
Actually, we had one.
Yeah.
We had one, that's, how far can it go? Maybe it's gonna schedule for work at 4 o'clock, and this is like 3:20.
Ms. Kimbler.
That's a lot of work.
May I please report to the members of the Ohio Supreme Court? My name is Rachel Ford, I represent the Akron Board of Education in this matter. What I would like to discuss today is that although my appeal is set at firm of the free spirit and allocation of court at 40 years of experience, so while I believe that the appellate court did have reversible error in both the first section and third section, my first proposition of law and my third proposition of law, I would like to focus my remarks on my second proposition of law, which deals with the issue of foreseeability, although I would be happy to take questions from the court on any other area. The facts of this case involve a 9-year-old girl who was in the fourth grade in Portage Tech Elementary School in the Akron Public School System. One recess, she looked around, saw some people playing different games, was playing on the playground, and wandered over and joined a group that was trying to get a jump rope and going to play tug-of-war. She knew what she was doing was wrong. How did she know it was wrong? Because she had heard an announcement the prior year when the jump ropes were initially purchased, the jump ropes were not to be used for any other purpose other than jumping ropes, such as don't tie people up or don't play tug-of-war. The children knew that what they were doing was in violation of this announcement they heard the year before and tried to hide what they were doing from the teacher. An accident ensued, and a suit was filed. And the question became, what was the responsibility of the school for this accident? The trial court ruled that the school was not responsible because this accident was not foreseeable under the facts and evidence before the trial court at that time.
At what stage did the trial court?
This was in response to a motion for summary judgment. In the motion for summary judgment, the court had before us the deposition testimony of Courtney DuBois, the minor plaintiff.
Okay, and didn't the court being simply say there's enough here to get you past summary? It didn't really.
The court of appeals here found that there was a material issue of fact, and I believe that thank you for bringing that up, because a material issue of fact is a fact that goes to something that is at issue in the case. The material issue of fact the Court of Appeals found is not appropriate for two reasons. One, it goes to a different point in time than when the accident occurred. The court said, Courtney said that she looked around and the teachers were talking to each other, not paying attention to them. However, this was earlier in the recess while the students were playing tetherball. It was not at the point in time during the recess that this accident occurred.
So, if we decide for you, what do we write? Write about a grand summary?
If you're asking the relief that I'm requesting, I would ask that you reverse the Court of Appeals.
I mean, what I'm asking, what's the great syllabus in this case?
The great syllabus in this case is that the creation of a rule by a political subdivision, in this particular case, a school, does not create foreseeability simply because the rule is there. The question is, why was this act foreseeable on the part of the school? What evidence was there that this was foreseeable that should have put the school on notice to prevent this act? The Court of Appeals found foreseeability simply in the fact that there had been an announcement the prior year that jump ropes were not to be used for any purpose other than jumping rope. Why would you make such an announcement? Well, because it's foreseeable that if you misuse jump ropes or if you misuse any other piece of playground equipment, then an injury can ensue. From this fact that the school could foresee an injury from a misuse, the Court of Appeals then made a leap and said because you had the rule, there was foreseeability that the accident would occur. It is not the foreseeability that the rule will be, let me back up. The foreseeability at issue is the foreseeability of the act occurring. And the foreseeability of the act occurring does not arise out of the fact that the school merely created a rule. And in fact, in the other cases that I cited in my brief, in many of them, the schools had various rules which were breached by the minor plaintiffs in each of those circumstances. And in no other case in the state of Ohio has an appellate court ever made that leap from the issue of, well, there was a rule and the rule was breached. The school wasn't made the rule that they hadn't foreseen that some injury would arise if somebody did that. Therefore, there was foreseeability that the person would create or do that act.
Your argument up to now has been based on foreseeability and no negligence.
Correct.
Why is your first proposition of law sovereign immunity?
My first proposition of law is sovereign immunity because I set my brief up under the three-tiered analysis of this court using Hayter versus Cleveland. The first one being that before you can even find, deal with the issues of liability against the school, you first have to find that there's an exception to the general grant of sovereign immunity.
Okay, so it's your contention that this act falls under sovereign immunity?
It is my contention that this court could rule in favor of the school district on the issue of sovereign immunity.
But you don't need that to win.
But I do not need that to win, and I think that it's important to reaffirm the general rule of all of the other appellate courts in the state of Ohio who have dealt with the issue of foreseeability. Foreseeability is proof of a fact that leads to a conclusion that the person against whom foreseeability is charged has some knowledge whereby they may reason that had occurred before it occurred again. How did the school, what evidence was it that the school had knowledge that on November 2nd, Courtney DeBell and her friends were going to use a jump rope, misuse a piece of playground equipment, and play tug of war and be injured? As the trial court pointed out, there's no evidence that there was ever misuse of this jump rope before. There was no evidence that the children ignored these rules. There was no evidence that the teachers had any trouble enforcing
them. Now, so let me give you something that maybe is foreseeable, and that is that when you turn a bunch of kids loose on the playground, sometimes they're going to do things that are dangerous.
This is not the kind of
you probably did. I know I did.
This is
and that's why you supervise a playground.
And
because
a great decision.
Find ways
this is my great decision. Let them play ball.
You know, I think we loaded stones into snowballs sometimes. That's pretty dangerous.
Well, Your Honor, in fact, that is
somewhat foreseeable, is it not? That kids will take lots of different instrumentalities or just using their own bodies and sometimes engage in other
teachers
in people's extremes. So that's what school supervisors are doing.
Your Honor, interestingly enough, in all of the cases in the state of Ohio, aside from this one, courts have dealt with that exact same issue and found that is not foreseeable, despite the fact, as in the words of Allison, research recesses the physical outlet for young students who have spent a few hours in class. In the time of play, the risk of injury is always present. This risk is partially minimized by the enforcement of rules, but it is unreasonable to expect that young children will be saved during recess or supervising and not through full of this short
help. I never
guess where I'm going.
Foreseeability.
I don't think you noticed.
Foreseeability is a legal issue under the standards set forth in the case in Ohio.
The judge gives the jury the law on the foreseeable on the jury. The jury takes the facts and decides whether to do this.
Your Honor, if you go through the brief and again the cases that I will give to the court from 1940 to the present, consistently the courts in Ohio in dealing with these exact kinds of issues have ruled that foreseeability is a legal issue to be determined by the court. From Boyer versus Jablonski, Pearson versus Gump, up through Case versus Westfall, and Miller versus Howard, and Williams versus Woods. Throughout all of these various cases, the courts have dealt with this issue over and over about supervision of minors in schools or on playgrounds. They have looked at the types of activities that these minors have been participating in, and they have said it is not foreseeable, in spite of the fact that one of them took place in a school for...
But the courts are dealing with things that they determine as a matter of law are not foreseeable, right?
Correct.
Those matters which they think may be foreseeable, they don't make a legal determination that it is foreseeable. They throw that to the jury, don't they?
That is correct. However, in these cases...
So we have a universe of all the activities.
Yes.
And then you have some cases in which courts have looked at these activities and said, these are outside the universe of foreseeability. So we're going to make a legal determination. All the rest are inside the universe of potential foreseeability, and then it's a jury question.
And, Your Honor, if you match up the facts of the Beau versus the facts in which the court said these fall outside the universe of foreseeability, they will always match. Because in all of those cases, the court said what evidence was there that this particular act would be foreseeable by these students at that time. And there is nothing in the facts of Dubot that match the cases in which the court allowed it to go to the jury. And they line up with the cases throughout the appellate district in the state of Ohio when the court said this is outside what may be foreseeable. Even before the enactment of RC 2744, the courts have really been hesitant about imposing liability upon the teachers or upon the school for acts of the students that were intentional or that were intentional acts of the students which were in violation of the rule. This goes back to cases such as Guyton versus Rhodes, where you had a milk bottle thrown by one student and another student, and then the student had a history of throwing milk bottles. In Boyer versus Jablonski, you had a student pulling out a chair from another student, and the student had a history of pulling out chairs from other students. In all of the other cases in which the court has said it is not foreseeable that they would do an intentional breach of the rule, the student actually had a history of doing those prior acts, and the court said it's not foreseeable that they will repeat them. So the question is, what evidence did the Ninth District Court of Appeals have to determine that this act by these students on this day was foreseeable? Because unless you get past foreseeability, then the actions of the teachers and the material issue of fact that you have identified that the court talked about is not material to the issue. So what we would ask this court to do is to clarify for the courts in Ohio which line of cases is more appropriate when determining issues of foreseeability. What I would call the Allison line of cases out of the 11th District or the Dubot line of cases, based on which this 9th District case is the first. I would posit to the court the different types of situations in which this could come up. If you say that because you have a rule, you therefore have foreseeability that the rule may at some point be violated, and therefore you're going to have liability. What happens when you have a chemistry teacher who passes out the material on the first day of class and says, "Now I don't want you to use these substances unless and exactly how I would like you to use them because they could be dangerous." Why would the chemistry teacher give that example? Because the chemistry teacher knows there are elements here that could be dangerous. So one of the students thinks, oh, liquid mercury, that's pretty cool. I think I'll stick some in my pocket when nobody's looking. The teacher is busy working with another student. The student B then puts the mercury in his pocket, slips out of the classroom, later comes down with mercury poisoning. Is it then the school's responsibility that the student took the mercury in violation of the rule? The teacher knew that you could be injured if you did it, so you have the rule, which was in order to protect the safety of the students. The students violated that rule knowing that they shouldn't be doing what they're doing. Does the teacher then have a duty to search the students as they leave the classroom to make sure the rule is not violated? Do the schools have an obligation to employ extra people in order to monitor the students to make sure that they are not violating the rule? To what extent is the school expected to foresee that the students will not follow the rules once they are promulgated? Again, in this case, you don't have any evidence that these rules were being violated by these students except on this particular day, and there's no prior history of this type of action by these students. I guess the question becomes, how far will we stretch the concept of foreseeability? At what point in the continuum then does the school become the insurer of the safety of the students? Also, because these types of dominant issues or these types of foreseeability issues are not limited to the school setting only, then will the issues of foreseeability be expanded to the public at large? As I pointed out in my brief, currently there is no responsibility for the school subdivision if they fail to enforce a statute or ordinance that they have against the nuisance. But if you expand foreseeability so that you say anytime there's a rule, you should know that that rule is to protect someone's safety, and therefore if that rule gets violated, the person enacting the rule has some obligation to watch make sure that the rule is not violated, how far will that reach out if judge has that the results were the ability to be taken? Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Kimbler. Mr. Taubman.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices. May it please the court, on behalf of my client, Courtney Bowes, the issue in this case is whether or not the lower court properly granted the defendant appellant's motion for summary judgment. And I don't believe the Court of Appeals, in their cogent, well-reasoned opinion, in effect, determined that there was foreseeability here. What they, in effect, indicated was that there were enough material facts by which the issue should have went to a jury, trier of fact, to determine where, in effect, truth might lay as to when Courtney indicated the teachers were not paying attention, whether or not there was adequate supervision, whether, in effect, the teachers were doing that job that they were supposed to do, and therefore they reversed the case. It is pretty clear to me that the trial judge, in effect, circumvented Civil Rule 56 by assessing the credibility of the witnesses without having had the opportunity to listen to the testimony. While it's a true statement of law that no general duty to watch over each child exists, the teachers in the school systems have to exercise that care to avoid reasonably foreseeable injuries. The Court of Appeal distinguishes the cases that opposing counsel cited, the Allison case, the Miller case, the Nottingham case, because they were assault cases. And they say it's considered to be more reasonable to expect school officials, as I believe it was Justice Pfeiffer had indicated, to foresee the misuse of playground equipment. I mean, it's not that we learned in law school that each dog has one free bite, but children will be children, and if you put teachers on the playground, then it's not a discretionary function. They're there. They're supposed to be doing the job that they're been hired for. It's like the court recently indicated in its cogent opinion of Perkins versus Norwood came out a few weeks ago. No sovereign immunity should exist for routine maintenance decisions.
Now, that's a different issue than what you're arguing now. You're arguing foreseeability and negligence.
Right.
Okay. I mean, that's what's happened. Those concepts have sort of blended or been slapped together, and they're clearly different issues, are they not?
Of course.
Okay.
Different
issues here. So, you're arguing up to the time you said sovereign immunity was all on foreseeability and negligence, wasn't it?
No question about it.
So how does that case apply?
Well, it applies that because I believe that the court will see that the issue of foreseeability should be submitted to the jury, and that issue formed the Court of Appeals for Summit County. Furthermore, on the issue of whether or not the court being, knew what she was doing, that's a question of comparative negligence. And again, that should be submitted to a jury for a determination of whose degree of negligence was, in effect, more serious. But for the fact that sovereign immunity was raised in the brief by opposing counsel and was in effect submitted as one of the bases to which the court should have granted summary judgment, I think in all fairness to my client, I should address it here.
Except nobody's talked about it except her or them up to this point.
Correct. No question about it. I believe that obviously a public school system is subject to the defense of sovereign immunity should they fall under A3 and A5, 2744. But in this case, it's important to note that the injury took place in 1995 and the effective modifications to the statute were in 1997. and we all know that legislation is presumed to be prospective in nature unless expressly indicated by the legislature to be retroactive. There was no indication of any retroactivity. There's no question but that Courtney DuBois was injured on school grounds. And A5 was not applied because, as opposing counsel has admitted in her briefs, there was no discretion employed in choosing the number of people for teachers to go out to the playground. Rather, they were just out there and not doing their jobs. They were not maintaining adequate supervision. My position as sovereign immunity is not a valid defense here. I'm going to reserve some of my time. I think, does anybody have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Taubman. Ms. Kimbler, you saved about 40 seconds of your time.
Only bringing up again the point that was frequently brought up by Mr. Taubman, and that is the other issue here is proximate cause. Even if you believe that the teachers weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing at the time that the injury happened, and again, there is no evidence of that, was that the proximate cause of the injury, or was the proximate cause of the injury the children's decision to violate the rule? And what negates against it being the proximate cause is the fact that the children, rather than saying, hey, let's do this, the teachers aren't watching, the testimony is the children took definite care and effort to hide what they were doing from the teachers. And so the proximate cause of the injury was obviously not any action by the teacher, but the action of both Courtney and her playmate in making this decision to violate the rule. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Take a brief